How's everybody doing? Last night, huh? The last of five. And then Buddhism in a Nutshell starts in January too, if anybody's interested. If you hadn't taken that yet, that's a good... Well, I can't. I've never been to it, but I hear it's a good one. And my wife is actually going to teach the next one, so I've got to give a little plug for her, you know. So. But I hear they're very good. It's good for people that are interested maybe in knowing a little bit more about what the whole Buddhism thing is about and just kind of, you know, it's a 5-week introductory thing. I know there's some people in here that have taken it. I'm talking to some other folks, right? It's pretty good, generally speaking. So it gives, in a nutshell, right? So, and then there's Discovering Buddhism, too, if anybody's interested in doing more. And you just come on Sunday mornings, too, you know, if you're interested in finding out more and kind of exploring. And, you know, all of these are available streaming, too, and recorded. I think you have to be a member, which is not a big deal. And then you can get to them online, which is a nice option, too, so... All right, well, I tell you what, we could start with just a little bit of meditation here. So if everybody's got their cell phones off, I obviously have to kind of remind myself to do that. And is anybody here for the first time tonight? Okay, all right. Well, you got some catching up to do. No, I'm just kidding. So you're good. You're not going to. You won't levitate tonight. That comes in the third or fourth session. So when we do a meditation, if you're sitting in a chair, again, you sit with your feet flat on the floor as much as possible. Back straight. If you're on a cushion, it's a good idea to sit kind of towards the front of the cushion so that your hips are higher than your knees if you can. And sometimes they'll use two of them. And then that kind of opens up your pelvis a little bit and straightens out your back pretty good. The idea is you want to keep your back straight, kind of like a stack of coins or be a curved stack of coins, I suppose. And then your hands are comfortable just in your legs and your lap. The traditional pose in this practice would be your right hand inside your left hand and your thumbs touching, but that's not critical. And the top of your head kind of pulled up a little bit, kind of aligned with your spine. I kind of picture a string holding the top of the head. Let your chin fall forward a little. Your tongue at the roof of your mouth behind your front teeth. And then your eyes either closed or you can leave them open a little bit to let a little light in if you want to. And if you want to keep your eyes open, try to focus on one spot as much as possible. And then we're going to just do, we'll let you all do just 5 minutes of either focused meditation where we're going to focus on either our breathing, and you can either count your breaths in and out, or just follow your breath in and out and try to keep your attention on the breath itself. And then if you're just following your breath, you can either, I like to just feel my abdomen rise and fall as I breathe in and out, and you know, let my abdomen actually expand in that process. Don't try to breathe in through, you know, hold it in your chest, but in your abdomen. Or you can focus your attention on the tip of your nose and feel the air going in and out as you breathe. And the idea is to remain focused on your breathing. And then, or alternatively, we can do a meditation where you just allow your mind to kind of open up like the sky or expand like the ocean. And then as thoughts arise, you know, if you're looking like a sky, just imagine there are clouds and just let them go. The practice here is to be able to recognize when a thought or emotion comes into your consciousness and kind of grabs a hold of your consciousness, your awareness, I guess, and then gently pull it back to the breathing itself. And the exercise is being able to pull it back and keep pulling it back to the breathing. And we'll build up some stamina in pulling our, catching ourselves drifting off. And we'll do a few minutes of just that type of meditation, and then I'll do a little guided meditation. We'll have a motivation here in a few minutes. So you can take a couple of big breaths in and out just to kind of clear your mind and settle your mind, or you can do the 9-round breathing if you want to. And when you breathe in, picture kind of clear white light going in and expanding around in your body. And when you exhale, imagine all the negativities and bad stuff leaving your body like soot and going out into the sky. So now that our minds are relaxed and focused, let's take a moment to set a motivation for coming here tonight and practicing this. And think about all the other things you could have been doing, especially this close to Christmas time, and yet you've decided that you're going to come here. Find out a little bit more about yourself. Maybe find out ways that you can be a better person to those around you. And that might be your motivation. And decide that you're going to try as much as you can to get what you can out of this class tonight, for the benefit of yourself and all the other people that you interact with. So taking the time to do this, you're going to develop your mind and become wiser and a kinder person. I want you to visualize in the space above your head a ball of white light, pure, transparent, kind of formless, a little smaller than the size of your head. And try to spend a few minutes concentrating on the presence of the light above your head. Don't worry if it's not real clear. Just enough to feel that it's there. And then imagine that this ball of light represents all universal goodness, compassion, and wisdom, and the fulfillment of your own highest potential. Then try to picture, visualize it decreasing in size, getting brighter, till it's probably about an inch in diameter or so. And this small ball of pure white light comes down to the top of your head to just about your heart area, your heart center. And then once there, it begins to expand again, slowly spreading to kind of fill your entire body. And as it expands, picture all the solid parts of your body dissolve and become the light. Your organs, your bones, blood vessels, tissue, skin, it all becomes this formless ball of white light. And then kind of hold that experience in your body as much as possible. And think that all the problems and negativities and hindrances have completely gone away or vanished, and that you've reached a state of wholeness and perfection. And along with that comes a sense of serenity and joy. And if a thought or distracting object comes into your mind, you can let that dissolve into the white light as well. And then slowly let the light grow and expand so that you're sitting in it. And it expands, begin to fill up and engulf the people next to you. And then it expands to fill the whole room. And it takes in all the negativities and dissolves those into the white light as well. Bringing that same sense of calmness and joy to everybody in this room. Everybody in the building. And you can even let it grow beyond the building. Maybe begin to encompass the whole block, the whole area around the center here. Expand out to the neighborhoods. All of Cary and Raleigh, Durham, the whole region. And you can allow that to expand to whatever size you want. And all the negativities that are taking place out there within that light get transformed. And then just try to hold that feeling as long as you can. How did that work? Were you able to visualize that? Struggle? No? Sometimes it's hard, you know? Sometimes you can get into it, and sometimes you can't, what I find. Does anybody have a hard time with the visualization? Not really. That's kind of a nice thing to do. This can be a challenging time of year for some people. You know, we've had people talk that, you know, family get-togethers maybe start out with the best intentions and they don't always end up so good. But, you know, there's a lot of struggles. But to do something like that, if you can get away for a few minutes, if you need to, and kind of allow that white light to expand to the whole house or whatever, sometimes that can, you know, calm things down a little bit. It's worth a try. Those kind of visualizations are a good kind of practice to just kind of, yeah, allow that stuff to kind of expand and grow a little bit. And some people do better with those than others, so, you know, play around with those. Anybody have anything, how'd it go during the last week? Problems, experiences, obstacles? May have anything they want to share? Oh, come on. is it going well? Is practice? Are you able to find time to do this during the day, or is it still a struggle, or is it getting better, getting worse?
I can honestly say that this has been pretty. It's had a huge impact.
Oh, good.
The last few weeks.
Okay.
I have genuinely felt different than I ever have before. What it did was, so like I said before, I've been practicing on and off for years, but what this did was, it kind of just gave it some structure.
Mm-hmm.
And because I was always returning back, I didn't come last week, but I still had a great Tuesday.
So
I
got
something else on. But this has been like going to the gym for my brain.
Yeah.
I know that's kind of a very simple analogy, and I don't mean to make it so. It's much more rewarding than that, but it's genuinely like, I feel like there's some sort of muscle, but like, it's one whole muscle in my entire body is getting stronger all the time, because I'm constantly returning to it.
Yeah.
And nurturing it and strengthening it by sort of just going back to the practices of it.
Good, good.
And my days have been very, very, very different.
Good. Good. It is, you know, I think it does make a difference when you create some structure. He said that things seem to be going pretty good because there's some structure to it, you know, and it gives him something. So it's, you know, again, and I think the analogy with the physical exercise is perfect. You know, you go to the gym and you do a little this and a little that, and then you think, well, you know, so if you just kind of test things out a little bit, but once you have some kind of routine, at least some structure to begin with, and then, you know, once you've got that routine or structure and habit in place, then you can start changing things up a little bit. Throw some other things in there and try them out. I find, you know, when I first started adding new things to the practice, I thought, no, I don't really care much for that. But what I've found over the years is that the ones I don't like are probably the ones that I need, you know. So I've tried to force myself to exercise those areas that don't necessarily resonate so well with me. And, you know, again, you kind of begin to develop your own practice. And everybody's is different. You know, everybody's is different. We all have different things that we kind of gravitate towards, and different ways of setting up, times of day, and, you know, your little altar or whatever, your little room, however you set it up, everybody's will be different. You know, surround yourself with little things that you like. You know, look at these little flowers. You got the little bouncing flowers here that they put. One of the nuns has. I guess they both do. But, you know, you put little things around that make you feel good, and set up a space for it, and develop some routine and structure. And I think you'll find over a period of time that it really does help. It's gradual. It's slow. It's gradual. Anything else? Anybody else have thing. This is probably, when I first thought, you know, they're going to do this between Thanksgiving and Christmas, I thought it was a bad time. But it's probably, in it now in retrospect, it's probably a pretty good time to be doing it because there are a lot of stresses and things that kind of come up. I just figured nobody would want to come, you know, but it probably, in retrospect, again, it's probably a real good timing to be doing this kind of thing. So, obstacles that people are having, anything that's a challenge? This is your last night to ask questions? Well, you can ask questions later. Yes, sir. Oh, Chris got the mic.
I'm sorry, not a challenge, but a question around Tibetan practices versus other practices.
Versus other practices?
Right.
Okay.
So you actually kind of took us through guided meditation. I didn't know what Tibetan aspects were going to be, so I didn't perceive what you've taken us through over the last few weeks is specifically Tibetan?
Yeah. Probably not. I don't know.
But that's just my perception.
Uh-huh.
So it would be good to hear some distinctions between Tibetan versus non-Tibetan.
Okay. Probably would. I don't know that I'm the person that would be able to do that. Though, I've listened to other things and I've read some other stuff. There's Zen, which is, in my understanding, you know, you sit and you face the wall, and it's just a lot of just sitting. I don't know that there's a lot of guided meditation in that process or not. And I don't know, anybody else have anything they want to contribute to that? I don't know what all the differences are in the different meditations. I'm assuming there's many, many paths, you know, and ultimately my understanding is they all kind of take you to the same place. There's a lot of routes up the mountain, and there's not any one that's necessarily better than another. Probably the critical thing, what I'm hearing, is having a guide or a teacher that you can talk to and ask questions, someone that you trust. And, you know, it should be someone you get to know and trust and feel comfortable with, because it's real easy to get down some sort of sidetrack on something that you may spend a lot of time trying to figure it out, and it might just be something real simple that somebody can tell you. And, you know, there's some things. We have one teacher that comes here that says that, you know, being mindful isn't all that hard. She said even criminals are very mindful, right? Someone who's robbing, you know, they're very thoughtful and meticulous. But it makes you think that, well, you know, you can have a misguided process too. So having a teacher, having somebody help you along the way is pretty critical. And there's lots of books and stuff too, but I really just kind of skirted all the way around your question, but I don't know. You know, I don't know what. But
actually, I wasn't looking for distinctions. Sorry, I didn't say it right. I was looking for some specificities around Tibetan Buddhist, you know, Tibetan practice.
Okay. Okay.
That's really what I
was looking for. Yeah. Okay. I've heard it described that Tibetan is pretty Baroque, right? I mean, you can tell by looking. It's very, you know, the tankas and things, and where maybe other practices aren't quite as, you know, whatever, a little bit more austere, whatever, but yeah. But I don't know much beyond that, so. Other questions or thoughts or obstacles? Yes, please. Gotta wait for the microphone. Chris is in his stocking feet too, that slows him up.
So I'm still having trouble with finding a space in my house to have that just for this.
Uh-huh.
I live in a pretty tiny apartment that tends to get pretty messy, and so, because I'm a messy person. And so that is not really an environment that's good for meditating.
Uh-huh.
And so I think I don't know if you all know where to get, like, to get these, or if you make them, or if you have, like, a little instructions or something, but I think having one of these and, like, actually making a little corner.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
would be helpful. And I really like these, and I feel like rather, because I thought I'll just have like a rug in my room, or like I'll sit in front of on this rug, and I just stuff just on top of the rug, and that doesn't work.
No. And you're not supposed to have these on the floor.
Yeah, okay.
Technically.
What do you mean on the floor?
Well, I mean like books, you know, teachings. You know, it's not a good thing to do. Yeah, statues and things like that.
Okay.
So you do want
them on this. Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
This I don't know who made these things, but we bought these. See the ones here that the nuns use?
Mm-hmm.
Those you can get at Home Depot. They're in the shelving area. They're for shoes that go in a closet.
Okay.
And they're like $8. You know, and you can put them together in 5 minutes. And they work great. So
you can also order them on Amazon. If you type in like meditation bench, a bunch of stuff will come up. So
okay. Meditation bench.
Same thing, but it'll cost you
$80. I was gonna say yeah. I saw these and I found one of those and we ended up buying a bunch of those. They work. The shoe rack works pretty good because then you got that other little shelf in there too. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay.
And yeah, and if you have a little corner, a little area you can set up, get a little bookcase or something, you know, you can set some things on. There's a couple of nice little books. They might be the ones that are free or real inexpensive on setting up an altar that, you know, kind of gives you some guidance. And it talks about water bowls and some other things too, if you're inclined to go a little bit further, you know, but just having an area that's designated, and you want to kind of clean it up. You know, I'm pretty bad too, but I try to keep that area pretty clean, and then hopefully that spills into other stuff too. You know? So that's a good question. Okay. Yes, sir.
It's similar question.
Uh-huh.
Who you talk to as a teacher for meditation or what book you read for meditation, there's always advice in there about a quiet, calm space, you know, that kind of thing. That's just fundamentally impossible in my life.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I live in a 900-square-foot home with 2 teenage daughters, a wife, 2 dogs, 5 cats. I'm just not going to find it.
All right.
I'll tell you what I've been trying to do, and then I'd like your feedback in that regards, is really just trying to approach my time when I'm sitting specifically for meditation as just another part of everybody else's life. You know, Geshe-la was talking last Sunday about how if you're trying to meditate and someone else is in the house and you're nagging them to please be quiet for another 5 minutes because I'm meditating. That's really counterproductive.
That's right.
To your
that's
meditation.
Right. Yeah.
And so I've found that I've really had to just, you know, embrace the reality that I'm not going to find that.
Right.
And I'm just going to sit on my couch. The TV is off. And I'm going to sit in the right posture, but people are going to move around me.
Yeah.
The dog's going to, you know, come up and sit next to me and snore, and
right.
and the cat's going to scratch at me.
Yeah.
And just try, you know, I guess my question is how important is it really to have a quiet space to be successful at meditation? And is it a lost cause if that's the reality that I'm going to live in? Or, you know, and how do you frame that right then if you're going to be in that type of situation where that's your only option?
Well, that's a good question. And I'm in a fortunate position where I don't have that problem anymore. I think you have to do the best you can with what you have. You know, I think the fact that you can sit on a couch with a dog and a cat and everything around, and if you can still make that work, that's fine. That's actually probably realistically more better practice than having some place that's absolutely silent, because that's not realistic once we get up off the cushion and go somewhere else. You know, you might try if the noise is a problem. You know, I've known people that just get like the headphones, noise canceling headphones, and put those on. And I've known people that'll prop up a book and make it look like I'm reading, but you know, you're really doing the meditation. And we work with prisoners, and that's got to be the worst place to try to meditate, because you've always got people harassing you and bugging you too. But they manage to kind of push through that and be able to still your mind and control your thoughts and do some focused stuff as best you can. It may be worthwhile finding another place, even if it's just once or twice a week. I'm just throwing this out as a thought. You know, yeah, come here. They open this up in the morning, generally speaking, if it's close by. Go to the library. You know, you can find someplace quiet and sit for some time. And I find that it's not just the noise, but it's if it's directed towards me. Because, like, I can sit in the middle of the mall at Christmas time, and I could probably sit there with that absolute chaos going on and do the meditation, because I could block that out. I'm not being pulled into any of that. But if I'm in a home environment where people are trying to talk to me, then that would be a greater challenge, I think. So if you have your family, your dog and cat, you know, not counting them, if you can, if they will allow you, you know, 10 minutes of just don't talk to me for 10 minutes if you don't mind, and maybe they will, maybe they won't, I don't know.
Yeah, they'll respect to not interrupt me from the standpoint of, hey, Dad, can you make me dinner now?
Right.
But it doesn't seem consistent with trying to have a harmonious household to say, everybody shut up and be quiet.
Right.
I'm going to meditate.
No, you don't want to go down that path.
But I wanted to check in with you about, you know, because you mentioned you can go down the wrong path if you're not careful.
Right, right. This shouldn't make things worse. You know, and maybe if you can get to your room for 5 or 10 minutes and have a corner in a closet, you know, basically, that you can set up and just throw one of these on the floor and get one of these things, you know, take the shoes off them, sit down, and, you know, do your thing for 10 minutes or whatever it takes. And you'll find that the opportunities will expand, and you'll be able to be mindful, I guess, in more and more ways and more opportunities too. So
that's what I was hoping for.
Yeah, yeah. Don't try to. See, the whole idea. This is interesting too. It brings up a good point. We think that we are naturally drawn towards our problems are all out there, you know. There are, and I mentioned this last time. There's a guy named Matthew Ricard. He's been touted as the happiest person on the planet. He's a monk, and they've put him in MRIs, and they've found out that his area of the brain is lights up the best, you know. But he can actually get into this meditation state, calm abiding state, where people have shot off guns next to him and they have him wired up and it doesn't even register. He's been able to control his mind that well. So, you know, we think that all of our problems are out there, and if we just get people to shut up, I'll be all right, you know. But it's all on the inside. So as long as we recognize that I can't get that train to stop, but I can allow my mind not to be disturbed by that train, then that really opens the door to what we're trying to accomplish here too. And I think that's why the prisoners do so well, because they finally recognize that chaos is just going to happen, and I've got to just be able to isolate my mind in a way. And when you do that, you realize that no one can disturb you. I can only allow things to disturb myself, and that's a real turning point once you kind of run into that. So again, in a way, you're fortunate that you've got that stimulation around, because you got something to work with. You know, I don't have that, so it's a more of a challenge for me, right? But yeah, just keep plugging away at it. Try to find some spots. So. Anything else? Yes, ma'am.
So between this class and other readings that I've done over the past year or so, they always bring up mindfulness, but I guess I'm kind of curious as to what your definition of mindfulness is.
Uh-huh.
I have my own, from, extracting from, this idea and that idea and what we've talked about in here. And to me, it just seems like it's kind of being more aware of kind of, your surroundings, what's going on around you, instead of kind of walking in la-la land. But I'm kind of curious as to what your personal definition of mindfulness is.
Yeah, I think that's it. It was meditation, and that just has a bad kind of PR thing going on with it. And so, that doesn't fly real well. And so Jon Kabat-Zinn was really kind of the one that got the mindfulness terminology started. So that kind of replaced it, because it's not quite as foo-foo, I guess. But the whole point about mindfulness, for everybody outside this room right now, right, is just bringing your awareness to what you're presently doing, to the present moment. Because we're always going somewhere else or thinking about something else. And it might be, we've practiced a couple types. We've practiced concentration, like on our breath. So, there might be instances in life where we have to concentrate. People that have hobbies, that they get enthralled with, like art or something like that, they concentrate on that and kind of get into a state of flow with that project. And then there's kind of the open space mindfulness that we've practiced, like with the ocean and the sky. And, I might have mentioned, so I was thinking about when I was driving here last time, when I first learned to drive, the kids are very focused on everything they're doing, so much focus on every movement that it's very uncoordinated, But they're very mindful. But then you reach a point where you've got this down and you can kind of expand that sense of awareness to kind of take in anything that comes in. I just read an article in the Search Inside Yourself in the book, and he was talking about the two types. One of them is that real close is, it's like a guard standing at a palace. And then certain hosts are allowed to come in, certain people are allowed to come in, and everybody else is very sternly but courteously turned away, That's the very concentrated mindfulness. And the other one is more like it's, anybody that can come, anybody that comes is welcome kind of a thing. So it's more of an expansive definition, I guess, of mindfulness. I don't know, does that help? But it's all boils down to being able to control your mind, being able to control your mind and just get back in the present, because that's really all we have. This is just a series of moments all strung together like beads. The past is gone and we have no idea what's going to happen in the future. None whatsoever. We like to think that we do, but we really don't. We think we have some control over that. I was going to talk a little bit about death meditation at some point, because I touched on that a couple of weeks ago. I don't want to get us too far off here, but some of these practices, the whole idea is to bring us in accord with reality, just absolute reality. And we have no idea what that is. We as individuals don't, right? Because we're always making up these stories about what's going on around us. So the death meditations, when you sit and recognize the fact that, I might not be alive tomorrow. And most of us don't live our lives that way. We really do have things kind of planned out and thought about and, what am I going to do? We live our lives as if we're going to live forever until we've reached the point where death might be inevitable. And then we start to freak out a little bit about it, So when we spend time thinking about how fortunate we are alive and what's the likelihood, this next moment's not a, is just a gift. You know, it brings you back into focus on the current moment. And so there's some real value in facing the reality that, you know, I might not be here tomorrow. I was a trauma nurse in a past life, I say. And I remember working in the emergency room and, you know, from some of these car accidents and things. And I thought, how many of those people knew that morning? I mean, if I could have told them that morning, you know, you're not going to live to the end of the day, they would have all thought I was crazy, you know? But every one of us is going to be gone in 100 years. And that's reality. But we just don't think about that. And we don't live our lives that way. So again, I don't want to get us too far down that path. There's some good books and there's modules in Discovering Buddhism that talk about death and dying. But you know, the Buddhists and the Tibetans particularly spend a lot of time thinking about it. You know, and I try to do some death meditation daily. You know, thinking, well, I might not be here at the end of the day, because that's truth. You know, it's not something we like to think about, but it's the truth. And so, when you begin thinking about it enough and recognize that truth, then the moments become more precious. You know, and it kind of pulls you back into the current moment and stops you from thinking about, you know, tomorrow, yesterday, this, that, and everything else. It just kind of brings you back into that mindful state. So again, it's kind of morbid. I mean, for us in the West, that's a kind of we just don't like to think along those lines, but it does some good to think that way. You know, the whole point of the meditation is to kind of break our habit of creating these stories and creating some negative thoughts that we come up with all the time. And then I know there was two questions from previous classes I wanted to readdress tonight. I think somebody asked last week about the difference between the analytical meditation and then I'm saying letting go of thoughts, right? So we try to let go of the negative thoughts that are just stories and biases, create problems for us. And we try to replace that with things that are better. We try to change those negative habits of thinking into more positive habits of thinking. And so the analytical meditation, the meditation that we did earlier, you know, with the visualization, was to begin to feel this sense that, you know, everything's fine. This is good, you know. It's good being in here. All that chaos is going out there. That's okay. You know, all that stuff's okay. I think, Karen, you asked about self-compassion. And I talked to Geshe-la about that a little bit and asked him some questions. But, you know, the whole thing, when we begin to embody ourselves with compassion for somebody else and people around us, we can't exclude ourselves. We just become part of that. He said, it's interesting, in the West, they're always talking about self-image, self-compassion, self-worth, and he says they don't think along those lines. The whole idea behind these practices is to get rid of our self-thinking, you know, and stop thinking about ourselves so much, because we're always thinking about ourselves. You know, the world revolves around me. Right? You guys are just all actors in my play. And when I start developing compassion for somebody else and realize that, wow, I'm just an actor in their play, and begin understanding with some empathy their viewpoint of the world, then I can begin to develop some compassion for myself as well, you know? It just kind of goes hand in hand, is what he said. So again, the whole purpose of all of these exercises are to begin letting go of our some of our negative thoughts that are habitual and replacing them with positive thoughts that become habitual, you know? So you can begin radiating that sense of compassion for other people. It's just kind of, it begins to just arise, you know? You see something play out, it softens your heart a little bit, and it just feels good, you know? That's the purpose, instead of thinking she's stealing that shopping cart, you begin thinking, oh, people are taking shopping carts back, you know? So it's just to change things around. And it takes a lot of work, because it took us this many years to build up the muscle that we're trying to now negate or try to get rid of, you know? And it's going to take a long time. It's a slow, long process. But, you know, how many of you, and this is one of the questions I wanted to ask, so how many of you now, after 5 weeks, feel like you, when a thought comes into your mind, you can let it go? Does everybody feel like that? That they've got, you know, here comes this cloud, here comes that fish, or whatever it is, I can just kind of push that aside. How many of you thought that you could do that before you came in here? You probably never even thought about it before, right? So that skill alone puts you in such a small percentage of the population of the human race, it's amazing, you know? Nobody else, you know, 99.9% of the rest of the population can't do that, because they don't know that they have the ability to do that. They've just become whatever their thoughts and emotions are. And people don't normally realize that I don't have to have that thought. I don't have to have that emotion. And I can replace that with something else. So just that piece alone was worth the price of admission, right? But it takes a long time to work on that and work on that and gradually replace those things with more positive things. But you recognize it's all within your own power. Here was with the kids, we do a class called Building Inner Strength, but it starts out with how we think, becomes how we act, becomes how we relate to others, becomes how we find meaning in life. And there's a little quote by Goethe that says, mind your thoughts as they become your words, mind your words as they become your actions, mind your actions as they become your habits, mind your habits as they define your character, mind your character as it becomes your destiny. It all starts with the thought. It all starts with the thought. And you can't change any of the rest of that if you don't change your thoughts. But once you do, and once you realize you can change your thoughts, then the whole, you know, the whole destiny thing kind of opens up. Because so many people just, you know, the actions just follow their thoughts without, it's that stimulus response that we were talking about before, you know. The stuff just comes out of their mouth, and then they think afterwards, boy, why did I say that? So now you have an opportunity to say, you can think it, but you don't, you know, you can keep it from coming out of your mouth. You can keep it from becoming an action. And then you begin working on, I'm not going to even let the thought arise, you know, and then you can begin controlling that as well. But it all boils down to how you think, and that's within your control. So again, if you learn nothing else, that in and of itself is, I think, valuable, and what most people don't know how to do. So, anyway, there I have blathered for a while. Anybody have any comments or other thoughts? Does that make sense? Okay. Let me make sure that it's like, yes, ma'am. You're good.
I guess now the challenge is knowing when to not speak and when to speak, because I think there's some things that I can keep to myself and it'll still be a problem, like with friendships and relationships with people.
Uh-huh.
So I'm doing a better job of not being so reactive and saying what's on my mind, but I think sometimes, I guess now the challenge is knowing when to say something and when not to say something.
Right. She said the challenge is knowing when to say something and when not to. Because you recognize that I don't have to say everything. And that's what they call wisdom, right? Knowing when's the appropriate time to say something and when's the appropriate time not to. Knowing that you can control it is huge. The wisdom part takes a long time, takes practice. You know, the kind of the bottom line thing with Buddhism is, it's kind of like, you know, being a physician. First, do no harm. You know, so if I can do nothing else but not inflict harm on somebody else, then I've really made some big progress, you know. I'll learn later on what's the right thing to say, but maybe not saying anything is the first step. So that just takes time and practice. And you know, then it's how can I be of most benefit to other people? One of the basic premises in Buddhism is, again, they say every problem that we have is because we're thinking of ourselves. And every joy that we ever get is through thinking about other people. So if we can just turn our actions around a little bit, that's a hard habit to break too. But if you can begin thinking about how can I benefit somebody else, how can I benefit somebody else, that's kind of, the rest of it will kind of fall into place, you know. But not speaking is the first thing. Geshe tells a story about a husband and wife that used to fight all the time. And the wife was tired of all of the arguments. As soon as the husband would come home, it was really bothering her. So she went to see somebody, and he gave her some medicine, a little jar of liquid medicine that he said that she should take that. And the advice was, when your husband comes home, take a mouthful of this medicine, and then don't swallow it. And after a few weeks, all of her problems went away, you know? So just not getting in that dance with that person is kind of, might be key. So just not saying something is certainly a good step in the right direction. Yes, ma'am.
I took a conflict resolution class from my grad program, and so you might be interested in it, but it's a similar concept, but you can Google it. It's called the drama triangle. But basically it says that there's a, when you're in conflict with someone, whether it's, you know, it's being spoken out loud or it's not, you play one of three roles, and but one of the roles is playing the victim, which is what I tend to play, and it's not that it's always if you're being quiet that you're being a victim, but it talks about refraining from conflict is important, but at the same time expressing your own needs is important in an assertive way, like an assertive and healthy way, or else you can have that victim mentality because you're not speaking up for your honest needs. And so just Google the drama triangle, and that helps me because I'm more of a passive person. And it's been hard for me to learn how to, in a healthy way, express conflict, because otherwise I'll just bottle it inside, and that can tend to be not healthy for me either, because then I get down on myself, or I'm angry inside and never coming out.
That's good. That's good. And we actually, with the 16 guideline thing, we talk about humility, patience, contentment, delight. You know, you kind of go through those, and Tibetans have divided all of these mental processes into different categories. But like humility is a good example. Doesn't necessarily mean you're a doormat, but it just means, you know. So we spend a lot of time talking about what does it mean to be humble, what does it mean to be patient. Sometimes people think that means you're a doormat, but it doesn't necessarily. You know, it's just a way of controlling your mind. Thank you. There's a lot of good material out there, but you're right. Just not saying anything is a good step. Don't get in the drama dance. And, you know, Jill out here, when she teaches this class, she does a good thing. She goes, you know, if you're in a situation with somebody, part of what this process does is allow you to pull back. You know, like a picture a camera, like panning back. Is that the right term? You know, pulling back. And then picture yourself and the other person as actors, and then say, well, how do I want me to act, you know? And you can change the whole scenario, you know, if you do that. And this practice gives you the ability to kind of say, kind of withdraw, you know, and be able to step back and look. Because you create that space. Were you going to say something earlier?
It was a really simple analogy to what she was mentioning about mindfulness and what he was mentioning about, you know, finding a space. And it all comes back to, like, a muscle.
Uh-huh.
And how mindfulness is something that starts off as just tiny, tiny glimpse into, oh, I wasn't thinking there for a minute. And all I did was just enjoy what was happening in front of me. It's just building up on that. And you get stronger at it, and you can take it with you throughout the day. It's not separate from your experience of everything. But the thing I was going to mention, the analogy I was going to mention was, I learned to drive a stick shift about 2 years ago in a really, really terrible car. Like a really, really terrible 95 Ford Contour that was beat to all hell. And the stick shift barely worked. It wasn't even the right knob for the car. And my leg could barely do it when I first got the car. I mean it, like I could barely do it. 3 months later, I could go up any hill in the area with no problem. And also, because I learned to drive on such a terrible car, now whenever I drive any stick shift, especially if it's a new car, it's so easy to just fall into the rhythm of it. And that's what mindfulness is. It's just falling into the rhythm of life.
There you go. Thank you.
Yeah,
it's that just being aware of whatever kind of comes in. And it does take, you know, it takes practice. Yeah. Takes time.
Years.
Yeah, long, long time. So, anybody else have another comment or anything? I've got a couple more meditations, guided ones, if we want to do those. And we will. And then we'll talk just a few more minutes, and then we'll be wrapping things up. So, yeah, if you want to get in your feet flat on the floor, whatever's the bottom half of your body needs to do.
you're not doing a death meditation.
I'm not going to do a death meditation. No. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to
run out the door.
I didn't mean to bum everybody else out there with that. They're good. No death meditations. Back straight, hands comfortable, head in the right position, tongue at the roof of your mouth, eyes closed. Take a few breaths in and out. I want you to imagine in the space in front of you three people. Someone you like, someone you dislike, and someone you're indifferent toward, maybe someone you barely know. And we're going to keep those images in your mind throughout the meditation. I want you to focus on your friend. And allow your feelings, that person, to grow strong. And feel how this person is definitely and truly your friend. They're good to you. They'll help you out. And then think about how you really want that person to be happy. And identify yourself with those feelings. Now I want you to shift your attention towards your enemy or the person that you dislike. They're not kind to you. They don't help you out. They don't do what you want. They may annoy you. Or make you angry. They might have done something to hurt you in the past. And then think about that person carefully and the feelings that you have about that person. And then thirdly, shift your attention to the person we're going to call stranger. Somebody you barely know. You neither like them nor dislike them. And then look at your feelings for that person, kind of indifference. Now, I want you to consider and recognize the nature of your relationship with these three different people and the labels that you've put on them. Those labels are based solely on what they've done for you or they don't do for you at this point in time. You've labeled them friend, enemy, and stranger. And think about someone in the past who maybe was your friend and then became your enemy. Or someone who was a stranger and then became either friend or enemy. Each of those labels, each one is temporary and impermanent. And it just depends on the situation at the present time. Move your attention back to your friend and imagine them doing something that would cause the friendship to end. Maybe they say something, did something against you, something that caused an experience of resentment, anger, and hurt. You feel hurt. How would they have done that? And then think, do you still have that warm, friendly feelings toward that person? And do you still wish them well and want them to be happy? So where's your friend now? And remember, that person wasn't your friend before you knew them. Then they became friend, and then they became enemy. So there's no real reason for feeling kind and loving towards someone that you've labeled friend in the moment. Those relationships change and will continue to change. Now move your attention to someone that you call enemy and imagine something that they did that would draw you closer together. Maybe a common interest, a word of kindness or praise. And look at that person and your feelings towards them carefully. Do they begin to kind of soften a little bit? Become warmer? You can learn to feel good towards someone who was your enemy. It's happened before and it'll happen again. And then move your attention to the stranger. And think about how maybe a single act of kindness or anger could put that person in either category, a friend or enemy. There really is no such thing as inherent and definite stranger there. there's no real reason to feel indifferent about that person. At one point in time, all your present friends and your present enemies were both strangers. So kind of maintain the awareness of those three people and think about how fragile and impermanent the relationships can be. It's only your own belief system that allows you to put labels of friend, enemy, and stranger on these people. And think about the possibility of change and fluidity. And all of those people, friend, enemy, or stranger, they all want happiness just as much as we do. So in that regard, they're all equal. And they're all equal in having the potential to develop their minds the fullest through these kind of practices. So really the difference that we see in people is pretty superficial. And it's based on our own narrow self-centered view, often mistaken, when in fact everyone's equal in deserving care and compassion. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't discriminate at all. On a practical level, our ability to distinguish between actions of individuals is important. But the point of this thought process is to develop some level of equanimity for people, equal regard for everyone, whether they help or harm at this point in time, and recognize that the labels we put on people are often arbitrary, mistaken, and changeable. While we're sitting here, I'm going to do one more meditation. If we can tolerate it. Imagine you're sitting here in the Gampa. And the door opens up to the front, and in comes somebody, and it's you 10 years ago, 10 or 15 years ago, you as a younger person. And they walk over and sit down across from you. And you're going to have a conversation with that person. What kind of advice might they tell you now? And what might you tell them? Would you like that person, and would they like you? Now that person moves off to the side, and the door opens again. And in walks an older person. Maybe 10, 20 years older. Someone around 60, 70. And they sit down across from you. Maybe older. And you have that same conversation. What kind of advice might you tell them? What kind of advice might they give you? Would you like that person? And would they? What would be the thoughts about you? Now the door opens one more time, and in comes a person with a cane, very frail. Let's say 100 years old, but still very much alive. And they come over and sit across from you. What kind of advice might they give you? And what might you tell that person? And what would your feelings be towards them and their feelings towards you? Sorry, that was a lot of sitting. Any thoughts on either of those? Were you able to do the equanimity? A little bit, yep.
Did anyone else ever... So when you pictured the three people...
Friend, enemy, stranger?
Exactly. What did people... see or feel, or I'm just curious, because for me it was a friend is sort of like this soft kind of glowing light feeling, and then the enemy was this like sort of darker gray harsher feeling, and then it was the person that was neutral was literally just, it was like being in an empty room.
Neutral.
Completely.
Yeah.
And I was just surprised at just how, just listening to what you were saying, able to just sort of like instantly change the state. That really surprised me at just how malleable it was, just by nothing was even happening. You were just saying something and you were changing the way I thought. Did anybody feel that way?
Were you all able to change those labels pretty easily? It's amazing how flimsy those labels are. Yeah. You know, when you start thinking it, we think they're solid. Friend. Enemy, you know, but it doesn't. It's really pretty fluid. And it may be nothing. A lot of times it's just a story we made up that switched that label on a person. Usually it is, right? Something that they did, they zigged when they should have zagged, and they get a different label. So it's pretty fluid. Any other comments or thoughts? 8:22. Sorry, I didn't mean to sit you that long, but I saw the clock was ticking and I wanted to get that last one in there. And I had a captured audience. You weren't going anywhere, were you? You might have wanted to. I'm sorry, were you going to say something?
I have a question, Dave.
Huh?
Well, first of all, Dave, you're something, you know?
No.
you have this way of talking. And
well, thank you.
You don't do the ums and the ums and, you know, all of that. And it's great to be, you know, it's just kind of great to be in the...
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank
I appreciate that. But
thanks for that. But why do we put the tongue against the palate?
Why?
Yeah, and you'd explain it, I forgot.
Yeah, so you don't drool. I wish it was something really, you know, exotic. But that's what I'm told, is that it allows the saliva to run kind of back of your throat and it keeps it from collecting.
Yeah, because I thought, actually, I've heard a different interpretation, which was...
Oh, good.
It was actually supposed to be a good thing because the saliva is actually good for our body. So
okay.
It actually kind of creates that. So that's why I was like, okay, wait.
That may be right.
Okay.
Anybody else got any? Jim? Chris, I'm asking for some folks that I've just heard. Chris, I just heard it's because you don't drool, but I bought that. Sounded good to me. Sounded scientific, but I don't know. I don't know if there's something else that's going on with it. There may be something else.
Okay. And the last thing, that dang thing was hard. That's all. This meditation was hard.
It was? Was it hard to picture the stuff?
No.
Okay, it was just, it felt...
It was hard to let go.
Okay. Hard to let go of the...
The emotions.
Okay, good, good. The whole point is to stir the emotions. You know, we don't realize how powerful those are, but we operate so much from an emotional intelligence standpoint. So to be able to cultivate those emotions is just a powerful thing. You know, in the West, we think we kind of throw the emotional stuff out, right? If it's not quantitative and measurable, it's no good. But that's not reality. You know, we operate with emotions. So anything, any practice you can do that softens your heart, that's really what you're trying to do, is soften it instead of making it harder. You know, I read the Cookie Monster, and I start to get blubbery. You know, it's just, I kind of keep working with it. But that's just a habit. You know, it just kind of arises as you start working more and more and more. And then you start seeing little things around, little interactions with people that kind of like, oh, you know, like seeing a little puppy all the time or something. You know, it kind of softens you up, which is good. You know, you want to kind of soften things up a little bit, so. Yes, ma'am.
I really appreciate the last meditation we did because I think that part of the meditation is growth. And so talking, especially the first one where you're going back 10, 15 years, who you were and
yeah.
who that person, what they would say to you, and then thinking forward.
It's right.
Like, okay, well, what can I do next to grow? What can I be doing next?
Yeah, good, good. Yeah, we kind of see ourselves whatever age we are. I don't know. I mean, I'm still a teenager stuck in a 60-year-old body, you know. So, but I still think along those lines. But you kind of get lobbed into that thing. I don't know. Just kind of stretches it. Yes, ma'am.
I think, too, it's a good reminder of to be self-compassionate.
Mm-hmm.
I really appreciate that last one. That was great.
Oh, good.
It reminded me of something that happened to me. When I was a senior in high school, our English teacher had us write a letter to our future self.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And she said, I'm going to keep these, and I'm going to mail them to you in 5 years. I actually didn't get mine after 5 years. It probably wouldn't have been that impactful because I would have been 23 at 50.
Yeah.
But I ended up getting it last year, so 10 years later, because it got lost. And my mom found it, and she was like, this thing, I don't know what this is.
Huh.
And so I ended up reading this letter to myself, to me in the future, from me in the past. And it was just like this. It was such a beautiful experience.
Yeah.
I actually cried.
Yeah.
it was nice.
I know, yeah.
And, you know, she said, you know, whatever you've been going through, you know, you've probably gone through some hard stuff by now.
Oh, wow.
If you have, I just want to tell you that, you know, to keep your head up and to be strong and you're going to be all right. It's stuff I would never say.
Wow.
So nice.
Yeah.
just that experience, it was very similar to that.
How good.
To remember that, you know, when you, I think it's a lot more easy to be compassionate about yourself at a different time period.
Right, right. You're a different person.
Right.
You're not the different person.
Would,
yeah. Yeah, thanks.
It's easier to think of yourself like a friend or something.
Right. Yeah, and I think that gets back to the self-compassion thing, like you mentioned, too. You know, you start feeling that towards people, and you just have to kind of include yourself in that picture, you know. And that's where I think Geshe-la said, you know, he doesn't understand the obsession with self-everything here in the West, you know, self-image, self-this and that. The idea is to become selfless, you know, give it all up. So, 2 minutes. Yeah, I will go a little over. We need to. Go ahead, Renee.
A couple of times tonight you've used the word heart. And usually when I come here, I'm always hearing the word mind.
Sorry.
I've been wondering if there was a heart component to these teachings. What I'm finding is that working with the mind is good for my heart, so it has an effect there, but is there a part of these teachings that is more direct about the heart, or is that just...
Well, that kind of brings up something this gentleman was asking about Tibetan Buddhism, and I've heard Geshe-la say that there, it's like the heart is where all the... How does he... You know, have you heard him say...
The mind is in the heart. The mind is seated here.
Right.
They'll point to the mind here.
Yeah, yes, that's it.
Yeah. And I hear heart-mind. I've read, you know, Alan Wallace talks about heart-mind. So they see the emotion and the analytical as not being two separate schools of thought altogether. You know, they say the bird needs two wings to fly, right? So there's always compassion and wisdom. And wisdom is seeing reality, you know, and compassion is just that, right? The wanting for someone else. Love is the wanting, compassion is wanting someone else not to suffer. And love is wanting someone else to be happy, you know? We kind of mix those terms up here, but they clearly define them differently. So, you know, wanting other people not to suffer and wisdom go hand in hand. So they blend those two together. Heart, mind. But there's practices for both, right? There's compassion practices and wisdom. You know, ultimately you see emptiness as the idea with the wisdom thing. And compassion is just that, right? They meld together at some point.
I think I have certain definitions. I've worked with certain words for so long.
Mm-hmm.
It's like...
Yeah, we're locked into that.
Locked into those definitions.
Yeah. Yeah, we clearly separate them much more than the Tibetans do. They really, I mean, it's the same, you know, it's all in there together. It's human. It's what makes us human and makes us a sentient being, you know, is the compassion and the wisdom. It's all working. It's all thought and emotional process. It's all kind of cranking out. We assume it's in our brain, right? I guess there's some scientific support for that, but you know, it's a whole thing for them, I believe. Yes, sir.
So this goes back to an earlier comment that you had, and
I'm sorry.
No. It's actually good, but it's left me with a bit of confusion as I cover it, and that is this idea of finding a guide. Because to me it seems just a little glossed over, especially as we're getting ready to end this session. You know, is a guide a one-to-one experience? Is it a one-to-many? What sort of tips and advice in terms of finding a guide through this might you offer?
A teacher is what they'll call it, or a guru, right? And it can be, wow, I struggle with understanding it myself sometimes. It might be a one-on-one with somebody. You know, there'll be people that'll have, like the Dalai Lama will be their teacher. And so there's, you know, thousands of people that would kind of follow his guidance. There are books out there on how to find a teacher and, you know, but they encourage you to dissect it. Don't take any of this for because we're telling you this is the way it is. You should always, they liken it to a goldsmith. You know, you want to take it and scratch it and examine it and melt it and do all that kind of stuff before you buy into it. And they expect you to do the same with the teacher, is to find somebody, you know, and they'll talk about, like, if you want to become an expert, a baker, that, you know, you find someone who's skilled and you taste their stuff and you practice it and you work with it and you seek that person out and then you kind of follow them. So, again, I've kind of skirted around that, but there are lots of books and ways to find someone. And it doesn't have to be just one person. You can have a few people. And they shouldn't contradict. You know, they shouldn't be contradicting anything. The way, this kind of neat, the teachings are all set up that they don't ever contradict. You're not going to find something in one of those books that says differently than what another one will say. So yeah, you just have to start digging. And maybe coming on Sunday, and I think one of the DB sessions is on finding a teacher. Am I making that up? Is that, what's it called?
Finding a spiritual teacher.
Thank you. All right. Yeah. Well, I wasn't making it up. I was pretty close to it. But I there's a lot of...
It won't come around again for a while.
Yeah, 2 years. But, you know, you can, there's a video, there's a broadcast, I think, you can get, go back and find those. So, yeah, that'll give you some guidance. But anything else? Wow, we're 4 minutes over.
You get overtime though, right?
Get a little overtime, yeah. I get extra pay tonight. speaking of which, feel free. I still got my little note. Please give if, you know. Again, this is all just, we're glad you could come. Hope you find something here of value that you can take with you and, you know, maybe come to some of the other stuff that's offered here. It's all offered free. This is like one of the only centers that have been set up like that, and they've done really well just by, you know, having the begging bowl out. So they've continued with that mentality, which is, I think, is pretty cool. Other centers can't figure out how you guys survive without charging for teachings, you know, but it works, right? So, all right, take a few minutes if you're not going to do it now to dedicate, you know, seal the deal, hit the save button, whatever you want to do, and think about, you know, what you've done here 5 weeks, and you've learned stuff that lots of people don't know, and you've got a leg up on working on yourself in a way that, again, lots of people don't realize you can even do, and then practice, take the time to do it, find the time to do it, you know, make it, and stick with it, and it'll get better and better and better, I guarantee that. If it gets worse and worse, find yourself a teacher. Something's wrong. You know? Some ugly things will bob to the surface, but that's okay. It should just get, generally speaking, should get better for you. So, have a safe trip home. Have good holidays. And we'll see you all some other time, I'm sure.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming.